upholding scientific research and discovery in respect, as we should, we must also be alert to the equal and opposite danger that public policy could itself become the captain of a scientific, technological elite.
We've signed a climate convention on the importance of economic instruments and free markets. Were included in this mammoth Agenda 21 document and the Rio Declaration. Now, let me be clear on one fundamental point. The United States fully intends to be the world's preeminent leader in protecting the global environment.
Coming up, Technocracy News. And good morning. This is Patrick Wood for Technocracy News and Trends. Today is May 22nd, 2019. The topic of today is primarily going to concern smart cities. Smart cities just keeps coming up in the news. And stories tend to cluster for some reason about smart cities. We have three very good ones today to give you an idea of what lies ahead for the so-called smart city. The first article we're going to talk about is titled Experts: Why American Cities Need to Be Smarter. Now, this is an apologist article about why smart cities really, literally, should be smarter and why people would want to have smart cities be smarter. And I wrote, as an introduction to this article, smart city apologists have a technological solution to every conceivable problem. But few understand the web of control that they are creating around all inhabitants. As Charles Dickens might have written, the future is utopian, the future is dystopian. Obviously a direct conflict, but Charles Dickens understood opposites when he wrote A Tale of Two Cities. The article starts out, over the past decade, the digital world has rapidly become connected with the physical and the corporeal. Our smartwatches can tell us things about our bodies or our surroundings. Wi-Fi connected doorbells with sensors can determine when visitors are approaching and then alert us when we are in the world. Our connected homes, coffee makers, sprinklers, and Alexas now automate convenience. The article goes on and just explains how different cities around the world are approaching the smart city phenomena, planning for it, spending money to achieve it. The article continues, though we are all too habituated in this world of IoT, the Internet of Things, it is a technological trend that is still in its early stages within other industries beyond consumer products. Connected devices work by extracting data from the physical world or, in reverse, taking data and applying it to material objects. When this concept is applied to the public realm, it becomes known as a smart city, where streets, buildings, and infrastructure are integrated with sensors and the internet enabled. As cities around the world add a layer of data and connectivity to their infrastructure, are American cities doing enough to make their metropolises smart? And the answer, of course, is not enough. They need more. But you notice the intent of connected devices is to extract data from the physical world. This is a mark of a technocrat, extracting data. It's the lifeblood of technocracy. No data, no technocracy. More data, more analysis, more AI, more processing, more social engineering, etc. This is a good story to read if you want to understand the basic concept, the underlying concept of smart cities. And I will say there are so many people today that are touting smart city technology, in many cases just because they're getting rich by selling it to cities around the world. The second story is titled, Location Technology is Key to Smart City Surveillance. The story's sponsor, a commercial company, by the way, called Here. They ask on their homepage, this is a direct quote, can data make cities more human? Of course, data cannot make anybody more human. Humans are human. Data is not human. Yet the technocrat mind has no problem in mixing the two concepts. But their website declares it's all about them, not citizens. This is a direct quote from their webpage. It says, It's really a utopia or oblivion moment. It depends on us architects where we want to go. Oh, it's where they want to go, not us. In reality, I believe, citizens don't care where technocrats want to go. And honestly, I think technocrats should rein themselves in and decide to consult the public about where the public wants to go, because it isn't where they want to go. The public does not want to be controlled. So this story is actually a sponsored story. It appeared in Business Insider originally, but it was a sponsored piece of content, and it goes through all kinds of different areas explaining why location technology is key. They have a section on emergency response, a section on utilities. I'll read you the first paragraph on that one. It says, with smart meters and geolocation, cities can, quote, see, close quote, and analyze in real time how people use energy and water consumption levels and make better decisions about managing resources. Sensors can detect a water leak and send technician to fix it before the customer is hit with a sky-high bill. There's the benefit. The downside is, yep, smart meters are going to track everything. It can see literally right into your home or business and then analyze and make decisions for you. There's a section on environment, a section on public health, a section on civic engagement, a section on participatory budgeting. And all of this is brought to you on the basis of location data. Track everything, not just the things that are fixed in the geographic location, but track everything. Everything that moves, cars, buses, bicycles, individual people, and other animals and so on that roam throughout the city. Location data is key. Now, in the military, I've done a broadcast on this before. In the military, there's a concept called geospatial intelligence. And that literally is the tracking of all things that move. And this is exactly what smart city surveillance is all about. It's rolling that technology over onto the smart city to track all residents within the city, analyze the data, and then make decisions on how social engineering technology or skills might be applied to modify behavior in the city. Now, the last story, which I'll spend a little bit more time on, has to do with opportunity zones. This has been a topic that I've talked about a couple of times now in brief. Today, we'll go a little bit deeper. Opportunity zones are an amazing phenomena that's sweeping the country. So far, I have seen virtually no one cover opportunity zones, at least from a critical point of view. And in fact, overall, opportunity zones just aren't talked about hardly at all, unless you're perhaps a CPA or a financial advisor trying to help somebody make some more money. The headline of this story, however, is Rockefeller Foundation and MasterCard team up on opportunity zones. Now, right there should be a red flag. Anytime Rockefeller Foundation does anything, you should pay attention. MasterCard, which is the consummate globalist credit card processing company, has teamed up with Rockefeller Foundation. That should be a double red flag that something is going on. If these two will team up on it, there's got to be something big in the air. They're teaming up on opportunity zones. My comment in short is Trump signed the opportunity zone legislation, which was called the Tax Cuts and Jobs Act, in December of 2017. And then 1 year later, in December 2018, he created, by executive order, the House Opportunity and Revitalization Council. This was to shepherd, if you will, the Opportunity Zone legislation. And he did it by executive order. One of the criteria of Opportunity Zones is that the governors of each state simply get to define where these zones are. They get to map them out. It's self-certified. In other words, the Treasury is trusting the governors to create the right kind of opportunity zone. And they're supposed to be low-income zones. In some cases, I've already seen some zones that are not low-income areas, but they're supposed to be. So far, governors have created 8,700 opportunity zones across the nation. There's a map, actually, available that shows all of these different zones in each state. And it's incredible because there's a lot of red ink pointing out where all these zones are. And now that the Rockefeller Foundation is showing up with MasterCard, the money tornado is accelerating. Now, wherever you see money like this accumulating, you can apply the old adage, follow the money, follow the power. What is going on here? I'll read a little bit of the article that appeared first on this. And by the way, I included the actual MasterCard press release in this article, as well as the actual Rockefeller Foundation press release. It starts out and says, the Rockefeller Foundation will spend $5.5 million to help cities take advantage of the Opportunity Zone program created in the 2017 Tax Cuts and Jobs Act. The initiative will give six cities funding for a chief opportunity zone officer to be embedded in the city government, as well as community engagement specialists who can coordinate investments that will help the community. Okay, so the money is being spent to create a new job called the chief opportunity zone officer. And they've picked several cities to pour money into to allow that position to exist. He will be the one that coordinates and develops and promotes opportunity zone investment within the city. Separately, the MasterCard Center for Inclusive Growth and Accelerator for America announced they will partner to help direct opportunity zone investment to distressed communities. The partnership includes an $850,000 grant from the MasterCard Impact Fund, as well as data science work, economic development tools, and research. So now the data shows up. This is the data crowd, the technocrats. They're swarming in on opportunity zones. Now a little history on opportunity zone. An opportunity zone is a designation created by the Tax Cuts and Jobs Act of 2017. It allows for certain investments in lower income areas to have tax advantages. And the purpose of the program is to put capital to work that would otherwise be locked up due to the asset holder's unwillingness to trigger a capital gains tax. Some estimates, by the way, including from the Rockefeller Fund, claim that the Opportunity Zone program will free up some $6 trillion worth of investable money that right now is locked up because of an unwillingness to incur capital gains tax were they to sell today. In order to qualify, the Opportunity Zone Fund needs to invest more than 90% of its assets in a qualified Opportunity Zone property that is located in an Opportunity Zone. That's defined by the governor, state governor. I've already mentioned in a previous broadcast that Opportunity Zones are being used to implement smart city technology in low-income and distressed areas within a larger city in order to achieve a beachhead, if you will. So the technology can be spread to other areas of the city once it's proven to work in the low-income area. And of course, in low-income areas, people have much less opportunity to resist these types of changes and these types of investments because they simply don't have the political power nor necessarily the training to be stakeholders in the affairs of their locality. The Tax Cuts and Jobs Act of 2017 was promoted and largely designed by an organization called the Economic Innovation Group. Their website is EIG.org, the Economic Innovation Group. And they're dedicated to entrepreneurship, they say. And so when they cooked up the idea of opportunity zones, it was on the basis of providing entrepreneurial opportunities for people of means that have large sums of money. And such is the case with companies like, well, let's say Facebook. Mark Zuckerberg, as an example, has billions tied up in his stock that he originally created when he formed the company. If he were to sell even 10 shares of his stock, it would almost be 100% profit. And if he sold enough of his stock in a given year, why, his income would be off the charts. He'd be in the highest tax bracket immediately, and he'd have to pay a huge capital gains tax because he sold that stock. The Opportunity Zone program allows somebody to sell such stock or other property with huge capital gains, reinvest the money into an Opportunity Zone project, and defer the capital gains tax on the original asset that was sold, up to 6 years at least. This is a windfall for people that have that kind of money. It won't affect people that are outside of that super rich class, I'm afraid. But the organization that started the concept of Opportunity Zones, the Economic Innovation Group, looking at their founder's circle is very instructive. One name that you recognize immediately as the founder and executive chairman of the Economic Innovation Group is none other than Sean Parker. You might ask, well, who is Sean Parker? Well, if you don't know who he is, listen, this is directly off their webpage with his biography. Sean Parker is a philanthropist and an entrepreneur with a record of launching genre-defining companies, the co-founder of Napster at age 19 and Plaxo at 21. In 2004, he joined with Mark Zuckerberg to develop the first online social network, Facebook, and served as Facebook's founding president. In 2007, Mr. Parker co-founded Causes on Facebook, which registered 180 million people to donate money and take action via Facebook. So there you go. The founder of the Economic Innovation Group is also the co-founder of Facebook. Another person who's listed in the founder's circle is Ted Ulliott. He was general counsel of Facebook from 2008 to 2013. And then he served for various other companies along the way, including as general counsel of AOL Time Warner Europe, several law firms as well. He received his JD from the University of Chicago Law School and his undergrad degree from Harvard. He has pedigree. The other people in the founder circle are all involved with various venture capital firms. Dan Gilbert is the founder and chairman of Quicken Loans, the nation's second largest mortgage lender. He's also a founder and chairman of Rock Ventures, the umbrella entity for his portfolio of business and real estate investments, and majority-owned NBA Cleveland Cavaliers. Rock Ventures and its more than 110 affiliated companies across the country employ more than 24,000 team members. So we see that the pedigree of the Tax Cuts and Jobs Act of 2017 really has come from big tech and from venture capital. And yet this was gladly signed by President Trump, who followed up in 2018 with an executive order that created an executive team within the administration to promote opportunity zones throughout the country. Now, given the pedigree of this act and the people behind it, is it really about helping the people in those areas improve the plight of the areas? Or is there a flavor of smart city technology hanging over it, where this money will be rushed in to implement projects for smart city technology? I suggest the latter. The way that the Tax Cuts and Jobs Act of 2017 was written, the various vehicles that can be used to pour money into these low-income areas, supposedly low-income areas, include creating public-private partnerships. In fact, in one sense, the entire program is a public-private partnership, but individually, if any investment group in an area create a public-private partnership with the local city, they can put that money in to the city, they can gain all the tax benefits from it, and the city gets the quote-unquote benefit of the investment. Now, public-private partnerships were originally an invention of the United Nations, as we already know. It's a way for private industry to get their hands on public resources and public assets and to promote sustainable development. We see that public-private partnerships have already been used across the country to spread smart city technology. Case in point is San Diego. They call themselves now the smartest city in the world. That may or may not be true. That's what they say. But they've been riddled with public-private partnership where outside companies come in, invest in the smart city technology in return for the data. Now, here we go again. The data is the lifeblood of technocracy and technocrats. The investors in the public-private partnership will gladly finance the sensors that go into cities if they have the opportunity to harvest the data. That's where the money is. That's where the return comes back. Do you think that Economic Innovation Group knows anything about data? Well, I dare say that Sean Parker does. As the founding president of Facebook, I rest my case. Opportunity zones are a recipe for disaster across America because they will attract money into areas that cannot defend themselves, and then it will spread to the rest of the cities once it's been proven and implemented. The first people there will be the ones that get to develop the rest of the city. Well, opportunity zones are something to look into further, and I hope within the next 2 or 3 months to be able to write a major story on opportunity zones and how they are progressing throughout the country. In the meantime, we can gain no solace by the fact that Rockefeller Foundation and MasterCard have teamed up to develop the opportunity zone concept throughout America. And there are, so far, 8,700 opportunity zones been identified. And that was by the end of 2018. I'm sure that number is greater today. I'm Patrick Wood for Technocracy News and Trends. See you next time.